If you are a teacher, parent, administrator, student, and or anyone who loves reconnecting children with nature, and you want to figure out how to cultivate learning gardens and nature-based curriculum, then this is the podcast, the Outdoor Classrooms Podcast. My name is Victoria Hackett. I am the founder of OutdoorClassrooms.com and the Secret Gardens Nature Classes. I love witnessing the magic that happens when children are playfully learning outdoors. Observing the return of wonder and curiosity when children are interacting with nature is pure magic. This is the podcast that is going to help you capture children's interest and give you not only inspiration, but some real life strategies that are going to help you figure out how to use the outdoor space, your outdoor space, as a teaching tool, so you can enlighten the playful learning experience for young children. Welcome to our Outdoor Classrooms community. Today we have Griff Griffith. He is a renowned nature interpreter and former host of Animal Planet's Wild Jobs, with over 30 years of hands-on experience, including fish and wildlife surveys, wildland firefighting, trail construction, commercial fishing, farming, and leading ecological restoration crews. Griff has dedicated his life to understanding and protecting the natural world. Now, as an ecologically conscious social media expert, he shares his deep passion for wildlife and conservation, helping people connect with nature and coexist more harmoniously with it. A captivating public speaker, Griff has appeared on CNN, NBC Nightly News, The Kelly Clarkson Show, MTV, various documentaries, and numerous other media outlets, inspiring audiences with his knowledge and enthusiasm for conservation. Through his work with Jumpstart Nature, Redwoods Rising, and as a natural and cultural resource interpreter, he continues to make a meaningful impact on both people and the environment. Without further ado, Griff Griffith. Hey there, Griff. Welcome to the Outdoor Classrooms Hello. Podcast. Nice to have you.
Yeah, nice to be here.
Great. So I want to jump right in and learn a little bit more about you and your backstory before you became a nature and cultural interpreter.
Well, I fell in love with nature in an urban mobile home park.
Oh, wow.
It's where my grandmother lived. And my grandmother, she was Depression era. So she was the ultimate environmentalist before I think maybe even the term was coined. But she, you know, she was homeless during the Depression with her grandma. And that brought her a lot of skills, including that in this mass expanse of pavement in this mobile home park in this urban area, she had a little square, you could call a very small backyard, and she planted lots of vegetable and fruit trees, of course, but she also planted some other plants, ornamentals and natives, and she had a little pond, and I thought it was the most interesting place in the world when I was 3 and 4. My earliest memories are in this backyard. And even when I was so little that I had to hold her hand and had a big old head, so I had to balance my head walking down these steps. We get to the bottom of the steps, and I'll never forget this day. It's one of my earliest memories. And she said, I can call toads.
Oh.
And I was like, of course grandma can. She's magic, you know. And I was like, call one. And so she's Irish, and she's got that stereotypical Irish sense of humor. So she like does this big ribbit, 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 ribbit. And she's like, okay, go look under that pot. So I went, and I turned over this upside down broken pot, and there was this big giant toad. And I picked it up and I was like, what is this? And it peed all over my hands. And she said, now you're going to get warts. And it's funny because I'll never forget that. And I was instantly just like, I love toads. I don't care if peed on me. This is amazing. I can't believe my grandma can call. And I was instantly fascinated with nature. Like that was the day. You know, I did get warts on my hands, and you know, correlation is not causation. Toad's pee does not cause warts, but it was interesting because I got warts all over my hands right after that, coincidentally. But by the time I was 8, I knew that wasn't a real thing. But I loved my grandmother's garden, and she moved to a suburban area and had a big backyard, and it was very close to a creek. And she taught me, you know, the more toads I have, the less insects. And so I started learning about integrated pest management from my grandma when I was very little. And I'll tell one more grandma story.
Yeah.
Just because I think with your audience, they might want to use some of my grandma's tricks. So another thing she did was we also moved into a new suburban house, and I got to clear some weeds. And my dad said, well, you can recreate your grandma's garden that you love so much in your backyard. So my grandma saved all her seeds, of course. And so she brought her seeds over and she said, did you pound up all the dirt clods? I was like, yes. She goes, did you rake out all the debris? Yes. You know, did you do all that? Yes, I did, grandma, just like you told me. She's like, all right, here's a bag of seeds. Go ahead and plant them. I'm going to go in the house and I'll be out and check and see how you did. Remember to rake over them and stuff. So I got out these, you know, it's mostly marigolds and things like that, you know, simple ornamental flowers. And I'm like sprinkling the seeds all over the place like I had seen my grandma do and had to help her to do in her backyard. And then I raked them all over and she comes out and she goes, are you all done? And I said, yep. She goes, did you make sure you planted all the seeds right side up? Oh. And I said, what? She goes, did you plant all the seeds right side up? And I was like, and I told a little fib. I was like, yes, of course, Grandma. I'm not so stupid to plant the seeds upside down. Maybe I was 6 or 7, not 8. But anyways, I was so ashamed that I didn't know that I went out there every day and I laid on my side and I looked to see if I could see any roots growing up so I could flip those plants before my grandma and friends and my parents saw that I didn't plant the plants right side up. And that's watching every day like that. I saw, you know, I learned the difference between, you know, some plants come up like monocots come up with one leaves, dicots come up with two. I watched the plants change. I saw the bugs that came eat them. And I became enthralled with plants. And 20 some years later, I got a degree in botany.
Wow.
Was from mostly my grandma.
Isn't that amazing? And I love the fact that you start with that because yes, our audience is early childhood educators and school age educators. And to think, you know, it's never too early to be introducing these types of things. And I also love that the way she introduced it was very organic and natural and something that was infused in her. Are there any other strategies that you can think of that would help educators with young children in terms of wildlife and conservation?
Do you know one of the things that I've done a lot of different jobs, and one of my jobs was state park interpreter, and all my experience before that was working with teenagers and young adults because I had supervised young adult crews in the California Conservation Corps for almost 20 years before I became a state park interpreter. And I started getting these little kids. I had very little experience. I did Salmon in the Classroom, which is a program out in the West where we take salmon. When I was in college, I would take salmon to classrooms. And so the kids would raise these eggs in these cold water aquariums, these salmon eggs. And then we would take them to the creek and release them someplace where we had already planted trees. So we'd go out and have this little field trip, do some restoration, creekside restoration. They'd get the eggs in the classroom. And then we return them to the place where those kids planted this riparian corridor, these riparian trees. And it's funny because we didn't do any official studies on it, but just staying in touch with friends, they told me that the vandalism rate and the poaching rate in that area decreased dramatically over the years because of this program, because there's all these guardians of this creek, because all these kids, you know, named these salmon and named these trees. So it became the sacred area. And I loved that. Didn't do that super long, but I loved that program. So that was the only experience I had with little kids before I became a state park interpreter. And one thing that I found out that I really didn't agree with a lot of the interpretation that was being done, the early childhood interpretation, it seemed way too explainy, way too guided, way too telly, and not enough showy. And I had a problem with that. And so I just told my, I was like, you know, maybe I was an ADHD kid or whatever, but like this never would have worked on me. Like this, I would have, like, you have me out here in the forest. Why are you controlling my every move and telling me what to do? And so I like kids to explore for themselves. I like to say, here's your area, go explore. And using whatever tool we need to, you know, so it could be iNaturalist Seek or iNaturalist. It could just be a net and a little white tray with some, you know, water in it for aquatic insects. But I think that doing is and kids making discoveries for themselves, even if it's wrong at first, just let them be wrong and figure it out. That's one of the things I learned from my grandmother. She didn't rescue me when I was out there every day looking for those plants that are coming. I had to learn.
Yeah.
And because of that, I knew way more about nature and plants than any of my friends did by the time we were in fifth grade. Like, I was way ahead of them because people weren't telling me, people were inviting me to explore. And I feel like that's something that everybody should copy my grandmother on that. Let kids explore. Let them learn on their own. Don't be so quick to tell them if they're right or wrong. Let them find out.
Yeah, that's brilliant. So one of my other questions before we get any further is I want to backpedal and ask you, there's so many educators that are resistant to take their teaching outdoors. They like the comfort of the four walls. They like maybe their kids in desks and tables and whatnot. Can you explain from your perspective, this amazing perspective, why are we having this conversation? Why are we talking about the importance of children exploring nature and conservation and so on and so forth?
Well, I want to tell those teachers that feel comfortable in the four walls that I understand. I was raised by a teacher. My sister's a teacher as well. I get it. I understand. And especially now, because it's such, so much more of a litigious society than it was in the 70s when I was a kid. We had 10 times more recess minutes and way more field trips than kids have now, which is a shame, you know, but it's not the teacher's fault.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of teachers are scared of the extra drama they might incur by going outdoors. But I want to say that we are on the precipice of a lot of changes, and they have the potential to be negative, like extinction crises and things like that. And we need stewards more than ever. And so those teachers who can sacrifice their comfortability to be solutionaries, to help kids make genuine connections to nature, it does take a lot of extra work, but you have no idea what you're creating. It could be such a beautiful thing. And like, there might be, you know, your Rachel Carsons and your John Muirs inside your classrooms that are just waiting to be let out of their egg. Mm-hmm. And that might not ever happen in a room because the childhoods are so much. I'm 55 and I didn't spend all my life indoors. I didn't grow up looking at a phone. And kids do now. And so the chance, the opportunities and the amount of time they're outside are so much smaller. So the classroom, your classroom might be their only chance to connect to nature, because they might go home where their parents also feel comfortable keeping them indoors and putting them in front of a TV or a video game or whatever phone. So you might be the only opportunity for them to really get outside and explore nature.
Yeah, I love that. You were on the Kelly Clarkson show, and mm-hmm. I was watching that. And can you share your national park story when the national parks were shutting down and what you did as a solutionary educator?
So I worked for, up here we have Redwood National and State Park, so they're kind of conjoined up here. It's an interesting situation that doesn't exist in other parts of the country. And I was working for state parks, but we also work with national parks. And when COVID happened, I had just got hired. I was 2 months in as an interpreter. So I worked in the field my whole entire life, you know, doing ecological restoration, mostly salmon restoration and stuff and fighting fires. And so here I am 50. I was like trying to get out of the field, you know, cause I didn't, you know, your body's, you can only fight fire for so long.
That's right.
You can only build trails and plant trees for so long.
And thank you for that work.
Yeah. And I did it for, since I was 18 years old. So it was time for me to talk about it now. So my boss at the time was like, what are we going to do? Oh my gosh. He's like, hey, Griff, you've done videos before. Let's all do videos and we'll just take the state park interpretation to videos. And I was like, what a great idea. So that's what we did since people couldn't come to the park. So we brought the park to these people and it ended up being really successful. And a lot of people at the time, you remember where we were all mentally, like a lot of us were depressed and it was a weird time. Some of us haven't got over it yet, to tell you the truth. But so we brought the park to them and it resonated so well with people that Kelly Clarkson saw one of the videos and invited me on.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. And so that was, it was a really cool experience to do that with her. And she donated a lot of money to us to help us continue our environmental education work. God bless her.
Yeah, it's beautiful, but then it really gets you thinking about if people, the accessibility of of using social media or something during that time, but during just even now after the time in terms of that connection. But mm-hmm. I love also the word, which you've dubbed the term solutionary. Can you talk a little bit about maybe some of the biggest challenges, maybe with specifically early childhood children and educators that you faced in your conservation efforts?
And again, I'll answer that question, but let me give credit to the person who coined the word solutionary.
Yes.
She's actually in your area. Her name is Zoe Weil. She's one of my very favorite philosophers. If you can get her on your podcast, I would highly recommend it. She's written some great books. I'm reading one of her books right now. It's called The Solutionary Handbook.
Oh.
And she wrote the book Most Good, Least Harm. She is the co-founder of Institute for Humane Education. So I follow her and read her a lot. I've read all her books, and some of them I've read twice. She's amazing. She coined the word solutionary. So I just want to, if all of you, if you don't know about Zoe Weil, you should go find out. One of her TEDx talks, she talks about Star Trek being a model for where we should head as a society. It's wonderful. So it starts off with her kissing Captain Kirk. So you have in real life. So it's fascinating story. So what was your question? I just wanted to.
Oh, so just in terms of using that term and reading these her work and all of that, how are, you know, and then looking at some of our biggest challenges in terms of what we were talking about before, in terms of we need more advocates, we need to raise the next generation to be aware and of conserving Mother Earth. So how can we marry all these pieces?
You know, that is such a challenge in today's world because of where we're going technologically. It's such an exciting time technologically. I mean, my mom was telling me she remembers when they first got a TV in her house, and now my niece is playing with AI, and they're both still alive on the planet at the same time. My grandma was alive, and she can remember, and my grandparents can remember the first car that came in town. You know, things have changed really fast. And so we're not even aware of how far we have, how many things got put in between us and the creek, us and the pond, us and the dirt. There's so many things that separate us from nature now. And a lot of very, very interesting, entertaining things that we can't take our eyes off of. So reconnecting kids to nature is so much harder than a field trip now. It's so much more challenging than a field trip or, you know, a plant on your balcony or porch. It's become way more difficult, but it's also never been more important than now. Because while all these technological things have become put in between us and the creek, there's more than twice as many people in California than when I was born. There's way more than twice as many people on the planet than when I was born. And there's half as many birds and half as much insects. So while we're distracted from what's going into nature or what's happening to nature more than ever, we're also have never been needed more by our furred, feathered, and scaled neighbors. Mm. So I think that environmental education should be a priority because we cannot survive without clean air, clean soil, and clean water. We can't have our AI. We can't have our spaceships. We're not going to Mars if we create a Mars landscape on Earth first. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So caring for nature and connecting kids to nature needs to be a priority globally and fast. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that we can do that, and then we have to do it in a fun way because we're competing with all these new technologies. And, you know, so what I call it is we need to use, since we can't get mandates to teach ecology as much as I would like us to, we need to become edutaining.
Oh, wow. I love that.
Very, very edutaining in order to get kids to look at nature, to want to explore it. And edutainment in the interpretation field used to be a bad word before the internet. But now we absolutely depend on being edutaining. Mm. So when I do videos, I would love just to talk about this bird, you know, how this bird builds its nest for everybody to just be so interested like I am. But that's not the case. You know, I'm competing with video games and social media videos of things blowing up. So you have to be goofy. You have to be entertaining at the same time. And that's really difficult, but we need to learn how to do it because those of us who care about nature and know how important connecting kids to nature is, we have to double down on this and we have to expand our, you know, our toolboxes to include lots of edutaining tools.
Yeah. You are so on the money with that. It is edutainment. Yeah. And to think about, you know, educators that might not feel comfortable with that piece, figuring out other ways to do that. But I think that that's kind of where we are. There's a sort of an urgency now mm-hmm. that we didn't have before. You are part of a new documentary that is coming out. Is that?
Yeah, it's called In Our Nature, and it's about the subject.
Yes.
So it was actually, the main backer of it is the North American Association for Environmental Education, NAAE. And it is about this subject, about how these different groups are trying to bridge real world problems with environmental education. So there's like three different programs that are featured in the movie, and one of them is Southside Blooms, which is in this neighborhood in Chicago that's like full of abandoned houses and abandoned storefronts and not a lot of opportunities, and how they're growing organic flowers and putting kids and teenagers and stuff to work to earn money and sell these flowers, these cut flowers. And then there's another example of a very rural place in Kentucky doing something similar, just using environmental education to bridge modern day societal issues. And so it's really fascinating. I feel honored to be a part of it. I just have a small role in it, but it's a bunch of solutionaries doing what they can to connect people to nature.
Yeah. And I keep imagining, you know, I think it's, if we could get every child access to an outdoor classroom at every school, that they have that access and that the teachers are trained when they come out of their training programs in connecting nature to their curriculum and standards and so on and so forth, then that would create some movement. But I think there still needs to be this edutaining, I love that term, and continue to sort of rise the tide and just keep talking about it, because I do think there is a very much urgency that we didn't have before. In terms of all of this, nature education, conservation, people spending more time in nature, with everything that's going on, what do you see as the future? We have my vision, but what, in terms of, in from your perspective, I would love your, what, how you envision.
I am so much more optimistic than almost any of my colleagues. So that's, I just want to put that, out to your listeners.
Personality.
Yeah. Well, I suffered from ecological depression really hardcore as a young man. Really hardcore. Oh yeah. I had terrible ecological depression. I did a lot of fish and bird surveys. I was a seasonal for 13 years. And I watched, you know, and then I also grew up in California in the Bay Area. So I watched ponds get drained. I watched creeks get put in culverts. I watched my neighborhood surround the last open space and the last jackrabbits in there. And I remember seeing the last jackrabbits killed by people's dogs, shot by older kids, hit by cars until there was none left. Like, I witnessed the forefront of nature destruction. I watched it here in California. And heartbreaking. You know, I'd catch turtles in a pond one day and the next day it was gone. I would catch stickleback, which are now an endangered species, the three-spine stickleback. I would catch them for fun and bring them home and put them in my aquarium, and those creeks all got put in culverts. And so I got by the time I was 18, I was radical. I was an Earth First, which was a radical environmental group. I did not like people. I thought we were just all, you know, I was very anti-human at the time, because I just saw people as destroying nature and not caring and being so separated. And I was like, the Earth would be better without us. And that's where I was as a young man. That was a dark, terrible place to be as a person who cares about nature, just thinking that I'm watching everything die. But then I started a career in restoration, where we were restoring, like, unburying creeks. Like, I work for Redwoods Rising right now. We daylight creeks. We unbury creeks. And fish come back within a year. Amphibians come back within a year. Wow. Nature heals itself very, very fast. I planted tons of trees when I worked for the Nature Conservancy and in the California Conservation Corps. I go out birding in these places where there were empty fields full of poisons after like being in agriculture for 100 years. I go out there now. These were riparian trees. They grew very fast. I go out there. I hear yellow-billed cuckoos, which are an endangered species that had no place to live. So restoration works. So I went from being this, the best thing that's going to happen is if humans go extinct, to we can do this. We can have our biodiversity and our quote unquote progress. And I really believe that. And I think it can happen in many, many ways. And one of the easiest ways for people to jump onto the optimist train is to get familiar with groups like Homegrown National Park, where you can, and Doug Ptolemy is one of my very favorite authors. She's written tons of books. He wrote a new book. I have it sitting on my shelf, but his book, Nature's Best Hope, is one of my favorite books, and it will help you get on the optimist train really quickly. But we can create habitats on balconies and porches and stuff, and we could help in much bigger ways than people realize. Just by planting a handful of native plants, you can really help nature. There's a lot of things you can do, and you don't have to do all of them, but planting native plants is a really, really great place to start. Yeah. So I've seen so much restoration now. I've seen, you know, there's a lot more people who care about nature and understand nature than I feel like there was 15, 20 years ago. So I feel like we are headed in a good direction. And I feel like there is going to be we are going to see some more bad stuff to wake more people up. Unfortunately, that's what humans need. Mm-hmm. Very sadly. But I think that we're not far from going over the hump and then people starting to realize. And one of the things educators can do that will help this is to show people their connections to nature and natural places. So one of the things I like to do as a person who does restoration, speaks for the third largest restoration project in the United States, largest forest restoration project in the United States, Redwoods Rising, as I tell people, we can do all this wonderful habitat restoration and provide places for nesting birds and the food they need to eat. But 70% of the birds that live in our forest, they migrate and they fly over your house, San Francisco, LA, San Diego, San Jose, all these big cities. These birds that leave our forest fly through your neighborhood. And what are they encountering when they get there? Your 5 outdoor cats, your tons and tons of lights that attracted all the insects and killed all their potential food, your ornamental plants from Asia that don't support any insects, so there's nothing to eat. Like, you could change that. You could get a yellow light on your porch so you're no longer bringing all the insects to exhaust themselves to death. You can turn off lights so you don't confuse the birds that migrate at night. You can plant native plants so there's insects there for these migratory birds to eat. We can do all the work in the forest and make it great, and everybody could say that's a great job. But if they're going to die flying over your house, or if they're going to die in South America because everything got removed, all the native vegetation got removed for your coffee. You can drink Songbird coffee, by the way.
I saw that video. That was a good video. I was like, wow. I'm not a coffee drinker, but there's a lot of coffee drinkers out there.
Oh, yeah. Please, folks, get Songbird coffee. Smithsonian labeled. It's shade-grown coffee is BS. They plant lumber trees with the coffee plantation, so it's not helping wildlife. It's got to be native. So Songbird Coffee insists that the growers plant native plants. So that's the one to get. It's a little bit more expensive. So if you can't afford it, like, ask grandma or grandpa or someone who's got some extra retirement money to buy you some bags or something. But it's good stuff. So kind of lost my train of thought. But there's things you can do
right
that can help, you know, nature that you think is far away. Like, well, I'm in the middle of LA. I never even get to go to nature. Well, nature comes to you. So do what you can to make, even if you just got a little tiny yard, no yard is too small.
The urgency of it. It's not just this is a nice thing to do, which might have been maybe a couple of years ago. But I think the message here is that we're now in a state that this is kind of an emergent. This is an emergency.
Oh, yes.
We need to move quickly. And it can be such a small thing. It can be taking the grass off your front yard or backyard and mm-hmm. changing that into a native wildlife garden that's going to bring the birds and so many other things. And then alongside of that, that's inviting families and communities. I run a nature-based program here in Beverly, Mass, and it's opened up my yard just to the community.
Oh, nice.
Little nature classes. And it's wonderful. It's sort of like, well, we have the space, so let's just create it into something that children can enjoy. So thinking about simple things that you can do, you know, it can be, and if you don't have space, I think like you alluded to in terms of, it can just be a little plot or mm-hmm. something on your porch. So something very, very simple.
Put 4 milkweed plants out there, call it a day. Like, you're making the world a better place.
Yeah. So just in terms of, you shared your personal story in terms of how you got into this, and you even shared some of your more personal stories about your, when you were a young man. Can you, are there any other insights that you would like to share, and or a seed of inspiration that you would like to share with our community that we haven't touched upon?
I think that I would tell teachers, especially young teachers that haven't been teachers for as long, that as a person who worked with youth groups and stuff for a long time, a lot of times you feel like you're doing all these extra efforts and nothing's paying off. And so it's hard to stay inspired to do things when you don't see, like when you're not really seeing results. But the thing about it is you may never see those results, but the results are happening. When you're planting seeds, you might not be there to see the flower bloom because your kids are going away from you, but you have to continuously plant these seeds. And I'll tell you why. I'll give you one. There's a million examples, but this is like the most, this is probably the best story. I took, Save the Redwood League asked me, they said, we have this man that donated a lot of money towards restoration and he loves your videos. Can you take him for a walk? And I was like, of course, you know, like I would love to, you know, someone who's like really supporting us and stuff. I'll take him for a walk. So he brought his whole family from England. So there was like 15 of them, seriously, because he brought both his ex-wife and his current wife, their friends. Don't ask. I don't know the details, but pretty interesting. And then all their kids they had. So all these, this huge group came and they were from England and they wanted to go on this long 4-mile hike with me. And so I was like, okay, here we go. And so we're walking and one of the Say the Rebel League people comes up to me and he says, this guy donated $5 million and he is open to donating more. And he was like coming up to me. He's like, Griff, let's make a video together and blah, blah, blah. And so finally I was just like, look, you know, we're out in the middle of the Redwoods. His mind's blown. I'm like, I have to know, why are you donating? You're from England. Why are you donating to the Redwood Forest Restoration in California, thousands of miles away from your home? And he says, I wasn't a rich kid and my parents saved their money and took us on a vacation out here. And I was 5 or 6 years old and we went to the park and there was an interpreter there in uniform and there was only a handful of people on the walk and most of us were kids. And so this interpreter like focused on the kids and blew our minds so thoroughly on this short walk that I never, ever forgot it. But they told me at the end that the redwood trees were getting cut down really fast and that these were the only ones that were protected. And I never forgot that. And I promised myself that if I ever could help the redwoods, I would. So when I sold my business and I got millions of dollars for it, I found you guys.
Oh, I just got goosebumps. Wow.
And I was like, who was this interpreter and where was this park? And he couldn't remember the exact park or the exact interpreter because I wanted to call that interpreter if they were still alive, because this guy was in his 50s.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to be like, do you have any idea that your little short 15, 20 minute walk just got us $5 million, possibly a lot more, and that this happens all the time? So teachers, do not be discouraged if you do not see the fruits of your labor. You might not see them. You might not ever know about them, but we need them. And if you keep planting the seeds, we will get those flowers. So keep planting.
Oh my goodness. I'm covered in goosebumps. That is a beautiful, beautiful story.
Oh yeah. It's one that I tell a lot. It stuck with me. I got goosebumps while he was telling me. And I was just like, oh, I wish I could find that interpreter and tell them.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's
so maybe if I keep talking about it, maybe the story will.
Yeah, you never know.
Yeah.
Oh wow, I could talk to you all afternoon. Are there any other insights, stories, things that we might have missed? I will put all your contact information in the show notes. But any final thoughts before we say goodbye?
I would just, you know, as people who are trying to save the world, let's not let our own prejudices get in our way. And that includes technology. A lot of us, we want to get away from the screens and stuff, but sometimes like you can't just take a kid that's used to always being on technology and suddenly make them interested in nature. It will seem more like a punishment if you're like, no phones, no screen, and now you're out in nature. Like, don't make being out in nature a punishment. Instead, have them incorporate technology into their nature exploration. Yeah. So I've seen a lot of people make that mistake. I used to make that mistake. I don't make that mistake anymore. I use iNaturalist, iNaturalist Seek. And like, if they want to use our technology, let them. It's this generation. We may not approve of it, but let's work with what we got because we have a planet to save.
We do. We do. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode. Before we sign off, we have an exciting opportunity for educators looking to bring learning to life outdoors. Consider enhancing your teaching journey with the Outdoor Classrooms Teacher Certification Program. This program empowers educators to transform any outdoor space into a dynamic learning environment. By joining, you'll gain skills to inspire students and foster a deeper connection with the natural world. Interested in making a difference with outdoor learning? Visit www.outdoor-classrooms.com to learn more about enrolling in the certification program. Don't miss the chance to expand your teaching toolkit and inspire the next generation with the joy of outdoor education. Thank you for listening, and remember to subscribe to our podcast for more inspiring content. Until next time, keep inspiring young minds.